Welcome to Metro Connection. I'm Rebecca Shear. And despite this, I don't know, indecisive weather, technically it's spring. So happy spring, everyone. May you one day be able to stash away your snow boots and your parka, and may that one day be relatively soon. Now, here at the show, we've definitely come down with a case of what I guess you could call spring fever. All this warm, then cold, then warm, sunny, then snowy, then sunny stuff has us feeling, I don't know, a little bit wild. So today we're doing away with our usual thematic approach to the program and bringing you one of our wild cards shows. And this time around, we're dealing out a hand that has a little bit of everything, like a new bill that would prevent hardworking residents of Washington, D.C. from being ripped off.
They would have the right to go in front of this administrative law judge and present their case and argue, you know, this is how much I was offered, this is how many hours I worked, but I was only paid this amount.
We'll also visit Chincoteague Island and check out the newest theater company to hit Virginia's eastern shore.
There are lots of older retirees here, and I've actually conformed some plays with permission from playwrights to make them, you know, the senior generation.
Plus, we'll unearth some urban streams, investigate a legendary curse, and we'll find out if our long-awaited Silver Line is set to open anytime soon.
This is just a far cry from where we were 6 months ago when everybody was saying, oh, we're going to get this thing in January, then maybe, well, February, March for opening.
But first, let's talk beer. Since 2011, the Washington area has been experiencing quite the beer and beer brewing renaissance. Bill Stewart of Bardo Brew Pub in Northeast D.C. has referred to this resurgence as beer 2.0. Why 2.0? Because as local historian Garrett Peck will tell you, D.C. already experienced beer 1.0 a pretty long time ago.
It's interesting to see in D.C., everybody in recent memory forgets that we had this lengthy brewing past that went all the way back to 1770.
And that's the subject of Peck's new book, Capital Beer, A Heady History of Brewing in Washington, D.C. I recently met up with Peck at quite the headily historic location in Southeast D.C.
We're between the Nationals Ballpark and the D.C. Water Pumping Station, and it's a big parking lot. And this was the site of the Washington Brewery. This was on the coastline when it first opened up, and then gradually all the land south of here, essentially about a block further south, has all been infill. But when the brewery first opened up in 1805, it was right on the water itself. It had a wharf and everything.
An English doctor named Cornelius Cunningham opened the place, and it continued brewing beer all the way until 1836. But lest you think that was the end of the Washington Brewery.
Now, the Washington Brewery, you have a little section in your book called One Brewery, Seven Locations.
Yeah.
It's had like seven different homes.
Yeah. The Washington Brewery was this quintessential name. Cunningham founded the very first one, and the very last Washington Brewery was in the 1990s. There was a very short-lived contract brewer that had picked up the name. But other than Christian Heirich, who was our best-known brewer in D.C., it's certainly the longest-lasting brewing name. But they were different companies, basically, and they were all a bunch of different locations. It was such a great name that one brewery would shut down, there'd be a couple years gap, and then suddenly someone else would rename their brewery as the Washington Brewery, because the name had credibility.
You write in your book the first brewery in the district is actually not in the district. It's in Alexandria. Can you tell us about it a little bit?
Sure, yeah. The very first brewer was named Andrew Wales, and he started brewing in 1770 in Alexandria. And of course, Alexandria then gets incorporated into the District of Columbia in 1791, which makes Wales then the first brewer in the District of Columbia. Not the first brewer in the city of Washington, but rather in the greater District of Columbia.
Moving forward in time, we've got the Civil War. How did the Civil War affect brewing here in Washington?
The Civil War was really a boom time for brewing in Washington. You know, there's just now this huge garrison in Washington. So all these little brewers all decide they're going to open up shops. So the city practically exploded with breweries during the Civil War. The Civil War then, I think, becomes this fundamental moment in American drinking history, because before the war, Americans, largely, especially American men, were drinking whiskey. But after the war, now they're drinking lager beer.
So what then ushered in what you call in your book the Gilded Age of beer in Washington?
The Gilded Age started really in the 1870s. And by the way, you can thank brewers for the invention of air conditioning and ice-making machinery. And that came about largely because of Robert Portner, who was the big brewer in Alexandria. and he was quite an innovator. Once you had this machinery invented, though, you could start to brew lager year-round and not just in the wintertime. But what that meant, though, is that you had to have the capital to be able to afford all this machinery. So that very quickly squeezed out all the family brewers. So, you know, this Gilded Age industrial beer emergence. So by the 1890s, there are six big breweries in the D.C. area. In Arlington, Virginia, back then it was Alexandria County, it was the Consumers Brewing Company, which became the Arlington Brewing Company. In Alexandria, you had the Tivoli Brewery, which was Robert Portner's brewery. In Foggy Bottom, you had the Christian Heirich Brewing Company and Abner Drury Brewing Company. And then on Capitol Hill, you had the Washington Brewery. There's that name again. And then the National Capital Brewery, each able to brew at least 100,000 barrels of beer per year. And Christian Heirich, of course, was the largest of all the brewers. He had half the capacity in the city alone. His brewery could brew 500,000 barrels of a year. So the other breweries kind of ganged up against him and are trying to force him to raise the price of beer because they're all being squeezed out by his capacity in the market. This was, by the way, called the Beer War of 1904, and it lasted for a couple more years. I think this finally just petered out. You know, they were faced up against a much larger nemesis by that point, which was the temperance movement, which was starting to really squeeze the saloons and squeeze the brewers.
Yeah, you write in your book, and I'm going to quote you here, nothing so threatened American brewers as the temperance movement. So can you give examples of how local brewers were so threatened by what was going on?
Well, first off, their main outlet for selling beer were beer gardens and saloons. And of course, on an annual basis, when the beer garden or saloon would renew its license, they would have to go before the board. And of course, there'd be a member of the Anti-Saloon League there to challenge them. And yeah, most of the breweries were simply to shut down entirely. I mean, only the two of them actually emerged from Prohibition, Christian Heirich and the Abner Drury Brewing Company. And Abner Drury closed within a couple of years. They just couldn't make it financially. Christian Heirich managed to stay open all the way until 1956. Heirich himself had died in 1945, just before his 103rd birthday, which is pretty amazing. And his family continued on brewing for another decade or so. And the brewing market was really petering out then, the local brewing market, just the national beer market. You know, Budweiser and Pabst and Schlitz had really taken over the national beer market. And little guys then, and Heirich is now a little guy, just couldn't compete against the national breweries now.
So again, here we are right by the National Stadium at a parking lot, basically, which once was the site of a brewery. What are some other sites around town that people might be surprised when they visit? Wow, there used to be a brewery here.
Yeah. The Tivoli Brewery, which was Robert Portner's brewery, that is the site now of the Trader Joe's on Washington Street in Alexandria. And that is, by the way, surrounding it are three extant buildings from the brewery, two different bottling plants and an ice factory. They've been repurposed for other needs, including one as a condo now. Other places that are kind of surprising. If you go to Capitol Hill, Stuart Hobson School, that was the Washington Brewery in the 1890s, all the way up until Prohibition. Also, the Safeway on 14th Street Southeast, that was the National Capital Brewing site.
So let's talk about beer's return to Washington. Things kind of went away as soon as the Heirich stopped brewing. So when did things kick back up again?
That brewery closed in January 1956, and then we went 55 years until another brewery opened up. We did get brew pubs, by the way, in 1992. David and Fawn Stork opened up Capital City, and his original site is still open. That's the one on New York Avenue at the Greyhound Terminal building, you know? But it wasn't all the way until 2011 that Port City opened up, followed shortly by DC Brow, and then you get Three Stars and Chocolate City and so on. We've had this wonderful flurry of production breweries and brew pubs. So essentially, just in 3 years' time, it's been a wonderful avalanche or cascade of beer. And it's been also really cool to see how much Washingtonians have really embraced local beer now. And for the book, Capital Beer, I literally had to draw the boundaries at the original 100 square miles of the District of Columbia, just because there are so many breweries now outside of the city, especially out in the suburbs. And this is largely because of real estate. It's cheaper in the suburbs, right? So we are not starved for choices anymore. It's a good problem to have, you know?
Garrett Peck is the author of Capital Beer, A Heady History of Brewing in Washington, D.C. You can hear him read from the book at Politics and Prose on March 22nd. For more information and to see a timeline of the many, many, many breweries involved in D.C.'s sudsy past, visit our website, metroconnection.org. So you can't make beer without water, right? And our next story is actually all about water.
although it's water you can't see yet. DC's Department of the Environment is about to do something it's never done before. It's going to take a stream that was diverted underground nearly a century ago and restore that stream above ground. It's a process known as daylighting, and the first stream to see the light is a tributary of Broad Branch Stream in Northwest Washington's Forest Hills neighborhood. Environment reporter Jonathan Wilson met up with project manager Steve Sari to find out what it takes to resurrect a stream and which other streams could rise up next.
So we're in a piece of land that is pretty much wooded, and it's a part of the Fort Circle Parks. There were all these areas where there were forts surrounding the city during the Civil War. And at one time, the National Park Service or the federal government had the idea of building a parkway that connected all of them. They never built that parkway, but they still have the linear connection between a lot of those parks. And this is one of those linear connections. And the exact location where we're at is just behind Connecticut Avenue near Politics and Prose. And there's a stream that comes out as a natural spring from the hillside and flows down to right near Broad Branch Road, where it goes into a pipe.
Why did you decide that this was something worth doing? Because I imagine it is, a difficult and involved process. You had, a stream that was pumped underground years ago, not necessarily a natural process, I'm sure took a lot of work. Why decide to undo it?
Well, my job and the job of our agency is to try and restore the water quality and health of our local streams. And this project hits many of those things. One, we're bringing a stream back where there wasn't one, so that in itself is restoring a stream, really restoring a stream. But on top of that, we're doing things to treat the stormwater that's coming off the roadways nearby to improve the water quality that will end up flowing into that stream as well. So it's a win-win situation, and it was just really straightforward because we had this open space where we could do it. We could see where the stream used to be, and the hard part was actually doing the designs and getting the negotiations with the different partners to get it in place.
Was this a common practice, and do other cities have a lot of streams that were placed underground?
Yes, this is very common. We wouldn't do this now, but in the 1800s and 1900s, this is the way cities developed, is that we wanted to get stormwater quickly away from houses. We wanted to develop densely, and we ended up piping those streams and building over top of them. Suitland Parkway, if you look at Suitland Parkway, it basically follows an old stream. Piney Branch Road, Spring Street, Broad Branch Road, all these are examples of areas where there were streams that were above ground that are now underground.
Right now, are we walking into what will be the stream bed?
Yes, exactly. This is the idea, is that the way they construct it is that they use the place where the stream bed is going to be as the road to reach the place where they're going to do construction. That way you remove the least number of trees from the project. You only impact the area where you're rebuilding the stream.
And it looks like here, we're looking at part of the project that they've constructed, there already is kind of like a stream kind of starting to develop.
Absolutely. The way the project is built is that water will begin to come up from the groundwater table and begin to perk into the system, and you'll start to see flow through the areas where we have, and actually downstream you'll see there's already a lot of water there.
It looks to me like this is a natural, you have trees that have look like they've fallen across, trees that are leaning across, and you're telling me that a lot of that is part of the engineering of how to design a stream bed.
Yes, it's part engineering and part artwork. The great thing is our contractor has both that engineering and art side to it, and these trees create structure for habitat, places for salamanders to hide, and shelter for frogs to hide underneath in the water. So it's not just there for aesthetics, it's there for the wildlife as well.
I know, just from doing other reporting on different streams and bodies of water around here, one way to kind of measure water quality is by the natural organisms that are living around and in the water. Do you guys hope that this will bring back species that haven't been in this particular area and plants that haven't been here in a while? Is that part of your goal?
Absolutely. In fact, we are going to see species that we haven't seen here. We don't, because we don't even have water, we don't have frogs and amphibians that would normally be here in the spring. I guarantee you this spring there will be frogs and amphibians here that weren't here previously. Just downstream there are wood ducks that live in the stream. They're going to start coming up this direction. We're going to see plants that you wouldn't find except for in these water-loving environments.
You've been, you know, with the Department of Environment for years now. How novel, how exciting is this process? You say it's never been done in the district before. Is this particularly exciting for you?
Oh, yes. It's very exciting for all of us. It's the first time it's ever happened in the district. It's one, as I said, of a couple dozen that have happened nationwide and worldwide. And it's taken us about 7 years to get to this place.
That was Steve Sari, project manager with DC's Department of the Environment, talking with environment reporter Jonathan Wilson. Want to see some daylighting in action? We have pictures of the crew's progress, along with a nifty informational video on our website, metroconnection.org. They say every cloud has a silver lining, but when will we get our silver line?
We're going through the list, we're checking it twice, and we're very much focused on getting these items done.
And an island, renowned for its wild ponies, steps into the theatrical spotlight.
Chai, please, I'm tired. I gotta operate tomorrow.
We're operating tomorrow, Doctor, but tonight we take care of Mortimer.
Stay with us. That and more is coming your way on this Wild Cards edition of Metro Connection right here on WAMU 88.5.
WAMU news coverage of labor and employment issues is made possible by your contributions and by Matthew Watson, in memory of Marjorie Watson. And support for WAMU 88.5's coverage of the environment comes from the Wallace Genetic Foundation, dedicated to the promotion of farmland preservation, the reduction of environmental toxins, and the conservation of natural resources.
Here, and welcome back to Metro Connection. Today we're bringing you one of our Wild Cards shows, so our stories are kind of all over the map today, from why DC wants to start unearthing buried streams to a new bill that would make sure paid workers are getting their fair share. Up next, we're going to take a look at something that's had a pretty wild ride here in the DC region, the Silver Line. It's the topic of our transportation segment, From A to B. So what is the status of this $5.6 billion rail project? Transportation reporter Martin DeCaro joins us now with, I hope, an answer. Hi, Martin.
Hi, Rebecca. And you know, I wish I had the answer the region has been waiting for, but I don't. We still don't know when the Silver Line might open to the public.
Okay, but it's been like, I don't know, a month since the last delay was announced. So what's happened since then?
Well, the agency overseeing the Silver Line's construction, the Metropolitan Washington Airports Authority, known as MWA, and the lead contractor, Bechtel, both say they're making progress rectifying the project's problems. Just to give you one example, the trackside computers that communicate between the train's automated safety system and Metro's headquarters, they're not reliable enough. They all have to be replaced before the project reaches substantial completion. Here's MWA board member Tom Davis asking the project's executive director, Pat Nowakowski, about it at their board meeting on Wednesday.
Okay, so how close do you think we are to substantial completion?
Okay.
If it's okay with everybody, let's just get it out now while we're here. What are the punch list items? Where are the problems?
We're going through the list. We're checking it twice. And we're very much focused on getting these items done and getting them done as expeditiously and quickly as possible. I can't and I give you a time because I don't have one right now.
Okay, so when we use that term substantial completion, what does that mean exactly?
It means the project is ready to hand over to Metro, which then has up to 3 months to test it and open it to passengers. But there are several eye-opening problems that are keeping that milestone from being reached.
Well, in terms of those problems, you already mentioned the communication system, but what else is going wrong?
Well, one of them is a little baffling. The contractors installed speakers throughout the entire 11-mile system from D.C. to Reston, speakers that have been used before on Metro lines. Inspectors said at first they were okay. They met the current code at the time of the Silver Line's design. But recently, inspectors with that same agency, the Virginia Department of General Services, said the speakers needed to be replaced because they did not meet the fire code. As it turns out, the speakers were first supposed to be used only for communications, then they were supposed to be added to the fire alarm system, and they were not up to the current fire code, too.
Oh, man. So now what are they going
to
do?
Well, it's all very complex. They have to be torn out, replaced, tested, inspected all over again. That's just one example of the problems that people are a bit surprised to learn about when it comes to holding up this multi-billion-dollar project.
So the contractor, Bechtel, what do they have to say about all this?
Bechtel says MWA has yet to specify what needs to be done to reach substantial completion, and Nowakowski finds that odd.
I don't know why a spokesperson said what they did. At the same time that quote was made to the news media, we were in a three-hour meeting with the executives from DTP yesterday afternoon.
DTP, by the way, stands for Dulles Transit Partners, and that's the contractor group that Bechtel leads.
Okay, so my question, if these delays persist, who's going to pay for all this?
That question is at the center of the next important date for the Silver Line, April 9th. Remember that one. If the project does not reach substantial completion by then, Bechtel can be fined $25,000 per day, a scenario MWA's chief executive Jack Potter says he'd like to avoid.
That leads us into a world of, you know, administrative nightmare. And I think all parties are interested in getting it done. So that's kind of the red flag that we're shooting at, and everyone's charging.
Now, Bechtel says that date is subject to change, but MWA is not so sure of that. Let's listen to Tom Davis again.
I mean, this is just a far cry from where we were 6 months ago when everybody was saying, oh, we're going to get this thing in January, then maybe, well, February, March for opening. And it just has kind of slid forward. And, you know, I think we need to convey to our partners on this the disappointment we see here.
So the public shares in this disappointment. The Silver Line was supposed to open in January, mid to late summer, now looks more like it.
Mid to late summer, so I'm thinking maybe we should just pencil this in as opposed to using, I don't know, a Sharpie?
If there's one thing we've learned about the Silver Line is be very careful about predictions. Maybe we'll use a dry erase marker.
Even better. Martin DeCaro, thank you so much for bringing us this update on the Silver Line.
You're welcome.
We turn now from getting around to getting paid, or in the case of this next story, not getting paid, even though you're supposed to. Over the past year, the DC Council has focused a lot on workers' rights. It's increased the minimum wage and ensured that everyone who works has access to paid sick days. Now, another labor issue is coming to the fore, and it has to do with employers who refuse to pay workers what they're owed. Lauren Ober has the story.
For 5 months, Mario De La Cruz went to work on a D.C. construction site where he made $15 an hour laying tile, installing floors, and putting up siding. Then, without notice, his employer stopped paying him. Still, the Guatemalan immigrant continued working.
Bueno, yo pensé como no me estaba fallando el pago, diga, bueno, sigo trabajando porque es una buena persona, ¿no?
He says he kept working because up to that point, he had always gotten paid on time and in full. But after a month, De La Cruz still hadn't received a paycheck. With overtime, his boss owed him almost $5,000. De La Cruz approached the supervisor, who gave him the runaround, and that's when he decided to go over his boss's head.
Pasando ya 3 semanas, vengo y le pregunto al dueño de la compañía qué estaba pasando, que ya pasó 3 semanas y necesito mi dinero.
He asked the head of the construction company where his money was. A year later, De La Cruz is still waiting for an answer. The kind of thievery that Mario De La Cruz experienced is common in fields like construction and hospitality, where many low-wage workers don't have employment contracts or access to human resources departments. 2 out of every 3 low-wage workers are likely to experience some form of wage theft, says Ari Weisbard, the deputy director of the district's Employment Justice Center.
Wage theft is any time a worker doesn't get paid what they're supposed to. So sometimes that means they're getting paid less than they were initially promised after they do all of the work. And sometimes it means they're not getting paid at all.
Annually, low-wage workers lose an average of about 15% of their income to wage theft, Weisbard says.
For low-wage workers, this is one of the most important issues.
Weisbard's organization and others around the district have been lobbying the D.C. Council to pass legislation that would help victims of wage theft have their day in court and ideally get the money they've earned. In February, council members Mary Che, Jim Graham, and Vincent Orange introduced the Wage Theft Prevention Act. It would overhaul wage and hour enforcement in the district by increasing penalties for unscrupulous employers and creating formal hearings for workers.
They would have the right to go in front of this administrative law judge and present their case and argue, you know, this is how much I was offered, this is how many hours I worked, but I was only paid this amount. And the employer would have an obligation to actually show up. Right now, they can ignore the Office of Wage Hour and basically delay a case indefinitely.
Last year, the Office of the Attorney General fielded complaints from 45 workers who claimed to be victims of wage theft. Their claims totaled almost $130,000 in lost wages. And those are only the people who spoke up. Nikki Lewis has worked all types of restaurant jobs, from server to bartender to manager. Along the way, she's seen countless instances of wage theft, starting with her own when she was a trainee server.
Typically, when you're not actually receiving tips, you are entitled to be paid the full minimum wage. After training for 2 weeks, though, not receiving any tips, I got my paycheck, and it was for $34. And I was like, what? and I was really depending on a substantial check.
Lewis confronted her supervisor, who told her she had actually signed a document when she was hired acknowledging that the restaurant would only pay her the tipped worker minimum wage, even though she would not be earning any supplementary tips.
And the fine print said that we're only going to pay you $2.33 an hour. So that's illegal. I at least should have been paid the minimum wage.
Lewis left the restaurant industry a few years ago and is now the executive director of DC Jobs with Justice, a worker rights organization. She recently spoke at a DC council hearing on the Wage Theft Prevention Act. One of the people to testify was Mario De La Cruz. Through an interpreter, he told the panel about his experience with wage theft and why he was speaking out.
Porque si me iba a quedar con los brazos cruzados, ya esa compañía o otras compañías siguen aprovechándose de la comunidad.
If I don't do anything, he told the panel, companies will continue to take advantage of workers and not pay them what they're owed. And for Dela Cruz and others fighting for fair pay, that's just not right. I'm Lauren Ober.
This year, the U.S. military is facing a massive task, bringing home tens of thousands of troops from Afghanistan, along with their equipment. At the heart of that effort are individuals charged with logistics, that is, maneuvering convoys of dozens of armored trucks through often hostile and rugged terrain. Jeff Clement is one of those individuals. The U.S. Marine is back home in D.C. and is about to publish a book about his 2 years serving in Afghanistan's Helmand province. It's called The Lieutenant Don't Know. And as Clement told Metro Connection's Jacob Fenston, his battalion was often the main link for Marines stationed in remote and dangerous posts.
Some of these places are small patrol bases in little villages, and so you might only have 20 or 30 Marines out there. The closest friendly forces are 10, 20 miles away from some of them. So yeah, when you're out there, you're all alone.
Talk about some of the challenges that you would face on a daily basis doing this. I mean, it sounds like part of it is, as the name implies, logistics, like figuring out how to get things to different places.
There's the initial challenges that any, you know, supply chain manager faces, as far as, you know, you've got to manage all the loads and, you know, everybody wants everything now and you only have so many trucks. And so you've got to prioritize loads and capacity and everything to make sure that they have what they really need when they really need it. And then you're also dealing with, you know, it's off-road, so the terrain was very challenging. You know, our convoys were really limited to going 3 to 5 miles an hour just because of how rough the terrain was. You know, dropping down 2 feet into these basically we call them wadis, dry riverbeds, and then trying to get back up the other side. Our trucks are amazing, but it's very rough. So you're dealing with that, you know, and then you get basically the external influence of the enemy. There are no front lines in Afghanistan, and a convoy moving 3 or 5 miles an hour looks like a really nice target.
That's a striking image, the idea of this huge convoy of armored vehicles traveling across, you know, open space and at 3 miles, 3 to 5 miles an hour, and people just being able to see you from, I imagine, from miles.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and the Helmand province, it's really got all kinds of terrain. You know, you've got rivers and some extremely fertile areas, you know, with farms and very dense compounds. And then you've got flat expanses of desert. So, you know, if you have a convoy that is moving at 3 to 5 miles an hour and they can see you 25 miles away, they have 5 hours to prepare to attack you. And there's only a couple different routes you can go on over this terrain that our trucks are able to handle.
What was the biggest danger, do you think, in traveling? Was it improvised explosive devices, IEDs?
Yeah, absolutely, without a doubt. You know, a direct ambush, well, it's not really fun. You know, it's something like, okay, I know that I can fight through this, and I do have an advantage in this fight. The IEDs is a totally different story. And the best sort of analogy that I can make, sort of, you know, what does it feel like to be in an IED explosion? It's kind of like a really, really bad car accident. But at least in a car accident, you can kind of see it coming, like, uh-oh, I'm about to hit the car in front of me. There's no warning in an IED explosion. Like, suddenly, you know, you're just slammed with this incredible force. The air fills with the smell of, like, fertilizer, because that's what they're made out of. Your visibility immediately drops to zero because the air fills with this cloud of dust. And that's just for the Marines who are in the truck, you know, that gets hit. It's almost more terrifying, you know, for me, especially as a platoon commander, you know, to see my Marines to be in a truck, you know, 3 or 4 trucks back, and to suddenly, out of nowhere, one of my trucks is in this dense cloud, you know, and you have no idea, like, are the Marines in that truck still alive? Are they okay? Time stops for that instant.
It seems like from a psychological standpoint, too, that could just be so, you know, with the ambush, maybe you would see people coming, you'd have some warning, mm-hmm. but with the IED, like, just to know that at any moment that could happen.
That is one of the things that I'm, you know, most impressed about my Marines and really impressed with the way that they handled it. Every mission, you know, we pretty much knew that somebody was going to hit an IED, but yet they went out day after day to get the mission done, to get those supplies to the people who needed it to accomplish our mission, you know, and to deal with that uncertainty and say, okay, you know what? I don't know if this is going to happen. I don't know when it's going to happen. They dealt with that uncertainty and that not knowing, which is a really uncomfortable feeling, but they had a job to do, and we did it.
What do you hope readers take away from reading your book? And I guess, who do you hope reads it?
My book, I really hope that it's approachable to people who aren't in the military. I want, you know, sort of the average American to be able to pick this up and sort of understand that, you know, everything that goes into war and everybody who's involved to make that happen. I think it's important, you know, especially as we contemplate future conflicts as a society, the total cost of the war, and it's beyond dollars and it's beyond just lives lost. Everybody who goes and fights in a war, they lose something and it costs them something. I wouldn't call myself a dove, and I'm not necessarily anti-war, but I think it really should be a last resort. I think really time will tell, you know, as far as how quote-unquote successful our counterinsurgency efforts have been. And you know, my book, I really focus on just sort of my piece of the fight and say, hey, you know what, this is what we did, and we did it well.
That was Jeff Clement speaking with Metro Connection's Jacob Fenston. Clement's book, The Lieutenant Don't Know, comes out next month. You can get a sneak peek on our website, metroconnection.org. After the break, feeling lucky this St. Patrick's Day week? Then perhaps you've never owned a certain 45.52 carat diamond.
As tragic things did happen in her life, there's evidence to suggest that she started to wonder whether something related to the diamond was dictating these problems.
Stick around. That story and more is just ahead on Metro Connection here on WAMU 88.5. Welcome back to Metro Connection. I'm Rebecca Shear, and as we continue this week's Wild Cards show, we'll turn now to a topic that's most apropos on this here St. Patrick's Day week, luck. But in the case of this next story, which we first aired back in March 2011, we're not exactly talking about luck of the good kind.
This is a 1947 headline, Young McLean Heirs to Decide Fate of Tragic Hope Diamond. That was the Washington Post. Unlucky McLean Hope Diamond left in trust to grandchildren. I mean, everybody had the curse stories.
And if you check out newspaper clippings from the 1940s.
Let me jump around here a little bit.
As historian Paul Dixon is doing.
So then what else is in here? I don't know.
You'll know exactly what curse stories he's talking about.
Diamond Jinx blamed for death of heiress. Even McLean Reynolds' death linked with Diamond. And the lead to that piece, the death of Mrs. Evelyn Walsh McLean Reynolds, 33-year-old socialite, today added another link to the chain that binds the family's fabulous Hope Diamond to tragedy.
So, okay, let's back up a bit. The Hope Diamond, for those not familiar with the world's most famous diamond, is, well, the world's most famous diamond. It's about an inch in diameter. It's a rare color, a deep, brilliant blue. And
the Hope Diamond came here in November of 1958.
It lives right here in D.C.
It's been here ever since.
And where are we right now?
The Harry Winston Gallery, the introductory gallery to our Gems and Minerals Hall at the Smithsonian Institution's Museum of Natural History.
Where Jeffrey Post spends quite a bit of time. He's been with the Smithsonian since 1984.
And I'm the curator of the National Gem and Mineral Collection.
So we can tell you a ton about the Hope Diamond, like how it came from India in the 1600s and was sold to a French merchant.
By the name of Tavernier.
Who then sold it to Louis XIV.
And then it became part of the French crown jewels.
Which were stolen during the French Revolution.
But 20 years later, in London, a blue diamond appeared for sale.
The same blue diamond, which many believe was then purchased by King George IV.
And then after his death was acquired by a private collector.
A certain Henry Philip Hope.
And of course, it's the Hope family name that stays with the diamond today.
And yet it can be argued that Hope isn't the diamond's most famous private owner. The gem eventually wound up in the hands of Pierre Cartier,
the famous jeweler in Paris, France,
who sold it to one of his best clients,
Evelyn Walsh McLean from Washington, D.C.,
whose name at the time was pretty much a household word.
She was in the papers every day. She was very attractive.
And, says Paul Dixon, she and her husband, Ned McLean,
who was the heir to the family that owned the Washington Post,
threw the most flamboyant parties at their mansion at 2020 Massachusetts Avenue Northwest,
which is now the Indonesian embassy. And then they also had another place, which is now known as McLean Gardens.
They bought the Hope Diamond from Cartier. And this, dear listeners, this is when those curse stories begin.
The following year, in March, her son is playing outside the mansion.
This is her much-adored firstborn son, Vincent.
And a car bumps into him.
So the woman driving the car knocks on the front door.
And said, I just bumped into him in my car. She was going at a very slow speed.
As the story goes, Vincent goes to the doctor. He gets x-rays. Everything seems just fine.
And he spends the rest of the day playing out in the yard, comes in at 6 o'clock and drops dead.
And Dixon says the public goes crazy.
This is within months of having fully acquired the Hope Diamond. And, you know, now the story is that Tavernier, the original French merchant, had plucked it from the forehead of a Hindu idol. And after he sold it to the French royalty, he was devoured by a pack of dogs. And it's also cited as the proximate cause of Marie Antoinette's death, etc.
That etc. also includes the death of another relative of Evelyn Walsh McLean. Evelyn Walsh McLean Reynolds, that 33-year-old socialite from the headlines.
Hope Diamond heiress is found dead in Capitol. This is the announcement that her granddaughter, beloved granddaughter, has died of an overdose of sleeping pills.
Throw in the fact that Ned McLean winds up dying in an insane asylum.
He had convinced himself that he was an assassin hired to kill Ned McLean.
And of course the public is going to go nuts. But, says curator Jeffrey Post,
no real evidence would back up a curse.
Not so fast.
For example, you know, it didn't come from an idol's eye. And in fact, Tavernier lived to a ripe old age.
As did many of the diamond's owners, actually.
In fact, one of my colleagues, Richard Curran here, has done a careful analysis of all the people who have come in contact with the Hope Diamond. And in fact, their lifespan is on an average greater than what you'd expect, you know, for the average population.
What's more, many of them enjoyed great prosperity.
You look back and there was a long reign during which the French royalty did pretty well in France. They acquired the diamond in 1668, and it wasn't until 1792 that there was a revolution. Likewise, you know, you look through the people who owned it in the 1800s, and many of them did pretty well.
It's all a matter, he says, of perspective. If you want to create a fabulous story about an object bringing bad luck,
well, you'll focus on all the bad things that happen to anybody who happened to be associated with that object.
And if you want to write a good luck tale,
then you just focus on all the good things that happened to those people over that period of time.
And in the case of the Hope Diamond, Post says the Smithsonian actually has experienced a lot of good since Harry Winston, who bought McLean's jewelry after her death, donated the stone.
These world-famous, spectacular gems that we have here on display with the Hope Diamond, almost all of these came here to the museum after the Hope Diamond came here. It was the gift from Harry Winston that really intrigued people to want to continue this idea of building a great national gem collection.
And it's a collection that millions of people come and visit each year. But while they enjoy all of those spectacular gems, the Hope Diamond, well, it's pretty much the star.
How much would it be worth today?
Priceless. I mean, if there ever is anything that you just can't put a price on, I would say it's the Hope Diamond.
And says Paul Dixon, how could it not be? In addition to being such a rare stone, it's managed to make its way from India to France to Britain, back to France, and of course, finally here.
And the rest is history.
Or at least, well, a darn good yarn.
Diamonds don't mean a thing if the loving touch ain't there. Rubies, rubies on a ring, you'll find them anywhere.
Time now to leave D.C. behind and go on the coast. That's our regular segment from our trusty coastal reporter, Brian Russo. And today, Brian takes us to tiny Chincoteague Island on the eastern shore of Virginia. It's a place best known for its natural beauty and its wild ponies. But that's not all going on over there these days.
Come on, Johnny. Let's go up, yes?
You're forgetting, Doctor.
What?
My brother Mortimer.
Johnny, tonight? We do that tomorrow or the next day.
No, tonight, now.
This is a scene from Joseph Kesselring's 1939 play Arsenic and Old Lace, which was recently performed by the Chincoteague Island Theater Company, a new troupe which is giving some local residents their very first chance in the spotlight. Brian visited a rehearsal and talked with founder Lexi Hubb about why she wanted to bring theater to this small seaside community.
I'm originally from York County, Pennsylvania. I grew up in community theater. I started when I was 8. I did musicals in high school and plays in high school, and I was still doing plays at two different community theaters. I majored in theater at Towson University, and then I moved to New York, and I thought, I'm going to do, you know, the New York directing thing, and that went well for a little bit, but then I came to a point where I was able to, you know, I had a lot of possibilities, and I decided my parents were retiring to Chincoteague, and I said, I'll come too. You know, the sunsets are pretty. And, you know, I was throwing ideas around with my mom, like, do you think they would want to do plays or start a theater company? So, you know, I did research and found the Chincoteague Cultural Alliance and emailed them, and they emailed me back pretty promptly. It was actually Bill Troxler who was in this play. And he said, sure, why don't you come and propose your ideas at this winter retreat that we have? And that was in March of 2011. And I came and I said, you know, I'm Lexi Hubb and I want to start a theater company.
And what was the reaction? Did people scoff at the idea or think, well, there's no way we could do that?
They were really excited, actually, because a lot of them had come from towns and cities, you know, where they had community theaters. And they might have done theater in college or in high school or something. So they were really excited. And I had a lot of big ideas. And I think I proposed this really big circus type idea. And they were like, okay, sure. We'll help you. And they really did in terms of volunteers and sponsors and whatnot. So they've always been my sponsor. Mm-hmm. They serve now as my fiscal sponsor. They allowed me to kind of go under their nonprofit umbrella. Sure. And they've been really great with allowing me to pick the programming that we do and, you know, letting me make my own decisions. It wasn't easy at first getting them really excited. And I'm also much younger than they are.
Right. That's one thing I wanted to point out, because casting, when you're mm-hmm. putting together a play in New York, for instance,
yes.
you have a different pool of people to
you can
choose
have anybody.
From. Right. Yeah. All age groups. Uh-huh. Then down here, which, you know, traditionally there are many people who retire here, much like
right.
your parents. Tell me some of the challenges about trying to cast a play here?
Oh, there were many challenges. One was that, you know, there are lots of older retirees here. And so if I need adult actors, that's great. And I've actually conformed some plays with permission from playwrights to, you know, kind of make them, the senior generation. I'm pretty certain I'm the only one who started a community theater in a town that hasn't had one. So that's, when I look at what they're doing, like on Facebook, I'm like, oh, look at what they're doing. Their shows, they have money to do shows and they look so good. So I get self-conscious about that. And then I take a step back and realize I'm younger than everybody's kids. And to convince them that I knew what I was talking about, it took time.
That was Lexi Hubb of the Chincoteague Island Theater Company speaking with Coastal reporter Brian Russo. The company's next show, Murder at the Banquet, is coming up April 25th and 26th. We have more information on our website, metroconnection.org. Our weekly trip around the region. On today's Door to Door, we visit Accokeek, Maryland, and the Clover College Park area of Alexandria, Virginia.
My name is Patricia Dane Rogers. I live in Clover College Park in the west end of Alexandria, Virginia. Clover College Park is located between Duke Street, Janney's Lane, West Taylor Run, and Quaker Lane. Clover comes from a 69-acre tract once known as Stump Hill, later changed to Summer Hill, that was sold to a developer in 1946. But it had 18th century roots, and literally the who's who of Old Town had a row of summer houses right where we're living today, starting in 1803. There are many interesting people who've lived in the Clover College Park neighborhood. Jerry Ford is unique because most neighborhoods can't say that a president lived in their neighborhood for 20 years. But he did, and he was a very active part of the community. He went to Emmanuel Church on the hill just on the other side of Quaker Lane, was an active parishioner, as was his wife. And his children early on went to MacArthur School. When we moved here 15 years ago, it definitely skewed older. I would say many, many people in their 50s and 60s, and even older. Now, I think that most are in their 30s and 40s and have many young children. You can have a full life and never leave Clover in College Park.
My name is Stevenson McElvain. I live in Accokeek, Maryland. Accokeek is located due south of Washington, about 20 miles south of the Washington Monument, down the Potomac. Mount Vernon is just across the river, just across the Potomac. You can see it from here. And from Mount Vernon, you can see this side. So back in the 60s, when there was a threat of a cement plant or a sewage plant or something like that, forgotten what it was, the Park Service, under pressure from the Mount Vernon Ladies Association, bought up the shoreline and put easements on all the land behind the shoreline so that trees could not be cut down. My favorite part of living in Accokeek is being this close to Washington and living a rural lifestyle. We farm. We're able to farm here, but we can sell our products in Washington. I'm not sure I want to say Accokeek is a great place to live because we don't want rapid growth. We're hopeful that Accokeek will remain rural and quiet and peaceful, not part of the obvious Washington suburban sprawl.
We heard from Patricia Dane Rogers in Clover College Park and Stevenson McElvain in Accokeek. If you think your neighborhood should be part of Door to Door, send an email to metro@wamu.org. And to see a map of all the doors we've knocked on so far, visit our website, metroconnection.org. And And that's Metro Connection for this week. We heard from WAMU's Jonathan Wilson, Jacob Fenston, Brian Russo, Martin DeCaro, and Lauren Ober. WAMU's Managing Editor of News is Memo Lyons. Metro Connection's Managing Producer is Tara Boyle. Lauren Landau is our Editorial Assistant. Our intern is Tyler Daniels. Lauren Landau and John Hines produce Door to Door. Thanks, as always, to the WAMU Engineering and Digital Media teams for their help with production and the Metro Connection website. Our theme song, Every Little Bit Hurts, and our door-to-door theme, No Girl, are from the album Title Tracks by John Davis and used with permission of the Ernest Jennings Record Company. You can find all the music we use each week on metroconnection.org. Just click on a story, and you'll find information about its accompanying song. You can also hear the entire show on our website by clicking This Week on Metro Connection. Plus, you can subscribe to our podcast there or find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and the NPR News app. We hope you can join us next week when we'll bring you a show we're calling State of the City. We'll go ward by ward in D.C. and investigate issues residents hold dear, from the redrawing of school boundaries in Ward 1 to public housing in Ward 4 to abandominiums in Ward 8. And in Ward 6, we'll explore the new $2 billion development that will transform the so-called little quadrant that could again.
We're not just about building new, it's about true rebirth. And we adapt to it while maintaining our core preservation.
I'm Rebecca Scheer, and thanks for listening to Metro Connection, a production of WAMU 88.5 News.